Mr. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
As an introduction, please could you briefly describe your career to date?
Well, I spent most of my time, most of my working career in the civil service from 1954 to 1992 as an administrative generalist, not a scientific specialist or international relations specialist. But I was sent, and I was quite content to be sent, to the defence field, and I spent 30 out of the 38 years in the defence field, originally in the old Air Ministry when there was such a separate department, then in the Ministry of Defence, short time, 3 years, technically on Foreign Office books, but as defence comes from the British delegation to NATO. And then back in the Ministry of Defence in various jobs, finishing as permanent Under-Secretary from 88 to 92.
You've had an awful lot of experience, particularly with the Air Force at the beginning of your career and then later on with NATO. And I know it's a very broad question, but I was hoping you could perhaps talk me through some of the highlights of your career recollections working with the Americans, again, under the pretense of the MDA.
I hadn't had very much direct contact until 68. In earlier jobs, I'd worked on aspects of the build-up of the V-bomber force, and I was private secretary to the chief of the air staff from the beginning of 62 to the end of 65, which spanned, among other things, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the transition from the Air Force being the wielder of the strategic deterrent to its transition to the Navy. But I hadn't had a great deal of direct contact with the Americans, and I do remember the formidable General Curtis LeMay coming to visit in about 1962, since I was private secretary of his counterpart. I have vivid memories of coming to the office. But I didn't, I think, get much involved in direct dealings with the Americans until 1968. I was posted on promotion to what we call one star rank to the fairly newly set up defence policy staff. My main single subject, which was pretty untilled territory in the Ministry of Defence, other than by a few far out scientists, was arms control. And that got me very much into the SALT One.
Yeah.
Business. Stop me if I use any terms with which you're not
that's great.
Not familiar. I was, I suppose, the central worker, though, with bringing in intelligence staff, scientific staff, as we worked up our view of that incipient negotiation, the serious work started in early 69, and I decided that we ought not just to think of what particular things might bug the British about that exercise. You know, we didn't want our forces caught in the mangle or anything like that. But we ought to think out for ourselves the whole SALT deal.
Yes.
Which we did. There are papers, I think, still accessible in the National Archives, which we wrote about the SALT One problem as it confronted the Americans, as we saw it. And we talked to the Americans, both bilaterally and in NATO, about that. I remember going across to Washington to talk to the people there. Philip Farley, I think, was the main American base man. He wasn't on the formal SALT negotiating team. And then there were a whole sequence of consultations in NATO where the American team or staffers from it came over to tell NATO how they were thinking, to discuss with NATO the particular issues that arose, for example, should there be an attempt to catch the Soviet intermediate range ballistic missile force in that, or should we let that go? So I was involved in all that, and I think had a good deal of influence on what the British stance was. And I got the impression, which on the whole I still stand by, that the Americans paid some attention to what we said, because we had made the effort to think it through, and because we knew something about the business, having been in it ourselves. So I had a lot of activity over the period 68 to 70 in that territory. I was involved also in other arms control, things like neutral and ballast force reductions and so on, but that was the main one, certainly, I assume, the main one of interest to your study. I was then sent across to Brussels to be the defence counsellor in the UK delegation to NATO. I didn't do much on the nuclear side there. Though it was formally within my area of responsibility, there was a tradition built up largely because of particular personalities, that the number two, the first secretary, who would always, we always said there's somebody, some ability and energy, would mostly do the nuclear planning group and all that stuff, direct to London. So the defence councillor, one rank up, on the whole, didn't get involved in that much. I talked a little bit to colleagues, including American colleagues, but it wasn't a central component of my job. I then came back to London, working mainly on army things, not involved with nuclear matters, and then went off to do Scottish devolution, Scottish and Welsh devolution. But I was allowed back home to the Ministry of Defence in April 77, in the job then called Deputy Under-Secretary of State Policy and Programmes, but what they now call Policy Director.
Okay.
And I had that job for 4.5 years, and that put me absolutely in the thick of a lot of nuclear issues. Mm. There was the completion, or the carrying forward towards completion, of the UK Chevalier programme.
Yes.
You know about that. There was the question of what we should do ourselves after Polaris, and that took me into the question that became the decision to acquire Trident, and I wrote into the Trident open government document, as it was slightly curiously called, though it was pretty open. And I was also involved in NATO and very closely with the Americans on at least two matters, apart from general questions of NPG doctrine, which was still evolving at that stage. One was the rather curious episode of the neutron bomb. Do you know about the neutron bomb episode? Shall I describe what that was?
Yes, please.
I suppose it must have been middle to late 1977, the Americans developed a proposal to deploy in NATO a particular sort of nuclear warhead, which would be of, it was called, the proper name was an enhanced radiation warhead. As I'm sure you know, I'm no scientist, but anyway, I learned that nuclear explosions emit energy in three main forms: blast, heat, radiation. The one it's most used to you if you're attacking, if you're trying to resist massive Soviet armed forces, which is, we thought, the main threat to NATO, is the radiation, which attacks the crews. Whereas blast heat, against blast and heat, they're tolerably well protected. And it seemed quite good to deploy warheads with the radiation component within the total energy output enhanced. Because of that, you not only got more radiation, but you reduce blast and heat, and therefore less unwanted collateral damage, whether to your own forces or to infrastructure or whatever. And the Americans wanted to deploy some of these. The public presentation, however, went hugely awry. Largely because an American correspondent called Walter Pincus, and I've forgotten, it may have been the Washington Post, but I wouldn't swear to it, got hold of this, and it got just the odd description of the neutron bomb. Absurd description, because all nuclear weapons depend on the action of neutrons, but that's by the way. And the presentation that caused the trouble was, attacks people and leaves property undamaged. That, as you'll gather from my description, is an absurd caricature of what it does. But it gave some campaigning leverage, and there was a huge fuss about this. The ultimate capitalist weapon. Particularly in Germany, to some extent also in the UK, and there was a lot of toing and froing over a period of, I suppose, 12 months or so. Britain and Germany eventually went down a bit on the limb, as it turned out to be, and said, this is a perfectly sensible weapon, and we explained why, over going with my then Secretary of State, Fred Mulley, to explain to various government backbenchers why this was a perfectly sensible thing to do. However, Jimmy Carter wrestled with his conscience and decided, in the end, not to deploy this thing, which left not only Britain and Germany looking fairly stupid, having invested some credit in defending it, and I think Helmut Schmidt never forgave Jimmy Carter. But it also and it had a damaging effect. And here was NATO having sort of come up for a decision and then backed off under campaigning pressure, which people largely believed, probably with some truth, had been orchestrated by the Soviet Union, you know, manipulating the likes of CND and so on. However, that was a brief and curious episode. The much bigger NATO thing, though it was affected in a way I'll describe by the neutron bomb fiasco, was the question of whether we should modernize what were called intermediate nuclear forces. And that became a very big subject. It had first arisen in 77, but from about the end of 77 onwards, it became a very large subject, handled in NATO by a thing called the High Level Group, which was a special thing set up, not part of a normal machine. It wasn't the MPG staff group, it wasn't ministry. It was essentially people, well, essentially people like me, people at about my level, but it was surprisingly diverse. Some people sent a senior military chap, others sent a senior diplomat. At least one country sent somebody who was just a very distinguished think tanker, though he later became a junior minister, in the form of Johan Holst from Norway, very able man. And we thrashed out this subject of whether, and if so how, NATO ought to modernise its intermediate nuclear forces, meaning by that forces based in Europe but capable of reaching deep, fairly well, if not deep, at least into Soviet territory, as part of the necessary deterrent apparatus, so that it wasn't a huge gap between the short-range stuff and the world-destroying strategic nuclear forces. And that became a major issue in which I think the UK played quite a large part, for a reason I'll come to. I was in constant touch, both bilaterally and in the multilateral forum, with all my US counterparts. And I think they would say that they found the British input both significant and helpful.
Can I ask you a quick question on that point? I mean, it comes down to something I think almost more inherent. Why do you think America chose to cooperate with Britain? So obviously the Mutual Defence Agreement, then Nassau, then Polaris Sales Agreement, and then obviously joining NATO. Why do you think it is? And obviously for Britain as well, why the two countries decide and continue to cooperate?
Well, there were in fact mixed views on the United States, certainly in the earlier years, about this. I think it flowed from a number of influences. General things like the habits and memory of World War II and the cooperation then, the fact that we spoke the same language in both the literal linguistic sense and more generally in ways of thinking. And I think they came gradually to recognise it was useful to have somebody else, as it were, to carry at least a bit of the moral and intellectual load of the nuclear business, and for reasons which I don't need to spell out, the French wouldn't quite do. I think they quite liked talking to us. Once they had got over that strand of opinion, I don't suppose it entirely went away, but at least it fell silent, felt that the British being in the business was a complication. And for both arms control and more general reasons, it'd be a rather good thing if the British got out of it or were squeezed out of it. I think McNamara certainly at one stage held that. And there were certainly people in the State Department at the time of the Nassau agreement.
Absolutely.
And it was very much a Kennedy-McMillan thing, and one of Hamilton's sort of great stage performances was persuading Kennedy that the British ought to stay in the business. I think there may also have been a strand that if you squeeze the British out of the business, quite apart from the fact you lose a friend, you may lose British willingness to pull its weight in NATO. Both because if the British are no longer in the first division, they may allow themselves to slide to the third. And also because if you, well, an alternative scenario would have been you squeeze the British out of the business, or at least you squeeze them by not helping them anymore. And then they would go the French way. Not only with a parade of independence, but also spending far more money on nuclear weapons than they would have done if the US cooperation had been there. And you finish up with De Gaulle's attitudes quite apart, a French contribution in conventional forces, which is a good deal worse than ours.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned there that Kennedy and Macmillan was a large factor in that sort. How important do you think then that personal relationships were in the Anglo-American relationship?
Fairly important. Not actually critically most of the time. When the chips are down, though the civilities are observed, America, like any other country, and perhaps more than most, pursues pretty rigorously its own advantage, its own national interest. And the idea that some sentimental consideration is going to move it off its perception of that interest is romantic. And I don't think that happens with any regularity or dependability. I think it's possible that the Kennedy-Macmillan thing did make a difference, but I can think of hardly any other stage where I'm saying that just being nice to us swung an American decision in a particular way. Or for example, we were at one stage fussed that when we wanted Trident, they might not give us the fully merved version. And I can remember working up and delivering at a meeting with the Americans in London with great passion. An absolutely brilliant account of why they absolutely must do it. And at the end of this, Reg Bartholomew, who was one of an old friend and one of the American negotiators, saying, "That was absolutely terrific, Michael. We're going to give it to you anyway." So I think, though there was, the relationship, I think, had the effect that the mindset was generally not unsympathetic. I don't think that there's any point at which I can say that the Americans did something for our benefit which wasn't adequately to theirs.
Okay, so if there was almost a common interest, if that's fair to say, do you think there were any points where America didn't decide or limited the extent of the help to Britain, particularly in nuclear matters?
Not that I can easily put a finger on. There was a period, and I'm not expert on this, I wasn't around at the time, and other people, Christian Stoddart, do you know?
Yeah, Christian.
Has dug with enormous assiduity into the papers. In the early 70s, when we were facing the question of how to keep ourselves viable in the face of Russian BMD, when one of the things being tossed about was the idea that we would acquire Poseidon.
Yes.
And though I've heard differing stories, and I don't know which is exactly the right one, of what drove the decision, it was certainly believed by some people, or claimed by some people, that the Americans didn't want to be asked because they would have felt great difficulty in saying yes, and might indeed have had to say no, because of the SALT negotiations going on. It was a huge complication to give MIRV away to somebody else at that stage. But even if that is true, I can't easily think of other stages where we wanted things and they declined to give us. The nearest approach, and it isn't a really very close approach, is that they were always very reluctant to have us talk to the French. There was an agreement, I think, quite early on, it wasn't the time of the MDA, that neither country would talk to any third country, meaning France in effect, without informing the other. And it was always made clear to us that the Americans didn't want us talking a lot to the French. I strongly suspect that the other side of the bargain was not kept with the same assiduity, but they were bigger boys than we were. The Americans, I think, always liked to deal with them separately and not have, the, as it were, the base of the equilateral triangle, it wasn't very equilateral either, joined. But that's a different thing from actually refusing to give us something, some piece of technology that we actually wanted. I believe in general the willingness to cooperate was almost unlimited. At least the limits never seemed to me to bear in on us with any serious discomfort. because I think the Americans had, for the reasons we've touched on earlier, had decided it was in their interest to have the British stay in the business, to stay in it cheaply, and to remain friendly and willing to help carry burdens in NATO of explaining things, defending things.
Now, you mentioned there cheaply, and that brings me back to the MBA and again Nassau and Polaris Sales Agreement, because they facilitated a cheaper alternative and therefore allowed Britain to continue in a much reduced cost in terms of nuclear armaments. So do you think it would be fair then to say that those three events, specifically the MDA, allowed Britain to remain a nuclear state? Was it a turning point in history for British nuclear weapons?
Well, it's difficult to evaluate alternative history precisely. Certainly if we had not had that cooperation, we would have faced some very awkward decisions to get out of the business, to stay in it in a pretty third division way, or to stay in the business, spend a lot of money and have severe opportunity costs elsewhere in the defence budget or the like. What we would actually have done, I don't know, very hard to say. I think that there would have been, and I suspect there is to this day, a very strong gut instinct, which makes it very difficult for any British politician to be the one who took us out of it. I think that's still somehow, almost genetically, a powerful factor. But there's some price which I think would have scared any, particularly perhaps in the 70s when we were in extreme financial difficulty. Some price which might have scared us off. But the American cooperation meant that we never came to that. The Americans were constantly reminding us that part of the deal was you mustn't cut your conventional forces. Mm-hmm. That occasionally, I think, worked to our advantage. For example, at the time of the Trident deal in 1980, the question arose of what about an R&D levy, an R&D contribution? Those in the American bureaucracy who were keen to see us keep up our conventional contribution worked, as it were, on our side to try and prevent an excessive levy being exacted. I think that the argument, the deal may have been different for when we moved to Trident D5, to the second phase of the Trident thing, but certainly at the first Trident stage, the deal was that we wouldn't pay a levy at all, but we would provide Rapier anti-aircraft defence for, I think it was, 4 US bases in the UK, a contribution, in other words, to NATO's conventional strength.
Okay, now I'd like to look back a little bit briefly on the earlier part of your career, particularly in the Air Force and your relationships with the people in the Air Force. Now, did you find that when Polaris did come into being and the nuclear force, as it were, was moved from the Air Force to the Navy, that there were inter-service rivalries, or, I mean, obviously there'd be some tension, but could you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Well, the argument about should the nuclear, the strategic component of the nuclear deterrent be land-based or sea-based, had been around, certainly since 1961, because I can remember in a previous job, before I became the Chief of the Air Staff Private Secretary, I was in the Air Staff Secretariat, and I remember going to meetings to discuss, to debate this under Treasury Chairmanship. It didn't, however, become a serious inter-service row in the way that one or two things like the carrier question became later on. That may have been partly because quite a large component of the Navy were not all that keen. No, this is not proper naval stuff, just going away and hiding somewhere for a month or 3 months or whatever. And though the Air Force found it painful to relinquish the strategic nuclear deterrent and in need to move out, by the same token, almost out of the strategic bombing business, which had been such a great thing since the days of Trenchard, that was disagreeable, and it was acquiesced in, I think, only with a certain reluctance. Come to that in a moment. But I don't think it wasn't seen as the Navy has done us down, because the Navy hadn't been the main driver. The main driver had been the cancellation of Skybolt, and to the extent there were any machinations behind that, it was the likes of Solly Zuckerman and so on. Feeling didn't run high into service terms about that. I mentioned the Air Force's reluctance. As you know, they continue to operate the V-bomber force with nuclear weapons for quite a long time, I think until about the beginning of the 80s. And I became aware in a later job that though they were NATO declared and had NATO plans, there were also obviously national plans for what to do if trouble started. The national plans were still had the Air Force for it for years and years until policy director had a hand in persuading them to change. Were very much we'll go and take out Kiev and Leningrad and Moscow in the old way. I caricature slightly, but I don't think the Navy took to the concept of tactical use of V-bombers. The Air Force took to the tactical use of V-bombers with any vast zest. The inter-service feeling became from about 64, 65 onwards, pretty intense, but it wasn't on the nuclear ticket at all. It was essentially about aircraft carriers and the TSR-2 lesser. The carriers were a central debate, which, for reasons which had something to do with A, with personnel and being with the organisation at the time, was run almost as an RAF-VRN boxing match.
Okay. Now, we've spoken a little bit about NATO already. Could you tell me a little bit more about Britain and America's relationship through NATO? Because in the early 60s, it was quite rocky. We had Nassau encouraging the MLF, and then the ANF, and then the Nuclear Planning Group. Do you think it's fair to characterise that as an extension of the relationship Britain and America had, or do you think it's something slightly different?
Well, I think the MLF story, that I wasn't involved at the time, I know a bit about it, illustrates the point that though we worked closely together, we didn't always agree. Mm-hmm. It was quite clear, as the way you phrase the question implies you know, that we were not enthusiasts for the MLF. Indeed, within NATO, we almost filibustered, as it were, to try and make the thing disappear into the long grass. And I can think of other things where our view would have been slightly different from the US. But I don't think it ever became really heated. The other side of that coin, I don't think I ever heard any American suggest that if you don't behave on this one, bad things will follow in other territories. I never saw any sign, either in the nuclear field or any other field, of an American attempt to manipulate or to leverage the cooperation they did give us to secure our compliance in policies with which we were not at one. I mean, obviously, we didn't go looking for trouble, and therefore it may have had a tacit psychological effect, but I don't think it was ever used as a lever. So we were able to disagree sometimes.
Okay, now, we've spoken a little bit about cooperation and NATO. Do you think then that accepting there are certain norms and agreed shared values and the self-interest that we talked about, that the character of cooperation has somewhat changed over the last 50 years? So we can see, or you could be argued at least, that in the period of, and I keep referring back to that, the MDA, Nassau, Glarus Sales Agreement, that there was a period of close collaboration. Do you think it's fair to say that we have drifted apart, or that we're drifting closer together now? What would be your opinion on that?
Well, I ought to preface what I say by noting that it's 16 years now since I was in the trade. Mm-hmm. And indeed, even before that, I hadn't been in the thick of the nuclear business. Mm-hmm. As Berlin Secretary, I had lots of other things to do, and on the whole let, particularly the very able Richard Mottram, mm-hmm. get on with doing this sort of stuff. So my opinion's out of date. But the impression I get is there's been no real drifting apart. There'll be the odd thing where we have a different view,
yes,
or put different emphasis on things. Ballistic missile defence is one of them. But I don't think there's been, from what people tell me in Aldermaston, for example, or in policy terms, any real divorce or estrangement. If there has been, it hasn't appeared on my radar screen.
Okay, great, thank you. In terms of then, and I know, obviously, as you say, you're not in the trade now, but you've got a wealth of experience, and that's really what I'm interested in, and your knowledge and your impressions. Do you think there could ever be a situation or a stage whereby Britain and America stopped collaborating, or do you think the future holds a continuation or even strengthening of the relationship, particularly in trading of nuclear technology and nuclear secrets?
I don't know about nuclear technology and secrets, but it does seem to me that a sundering of the relationship would be a nuclear event, as it were, in itself. It would be something very extraordinary would have to happen for the US, for example, to pull the plug on the Trident arrangements and so on. There would have to be a row about something else of mega proportions, and that seems to be beyond the realm of reasonable policy insurance. In some ways, I think there's at least as strong a case as there ever was for us to stay close together and to talk about, if not sort of nuclear weapon design issues and the like. I believe that Aldermaston may have some contribution to make, from what people tell me, to the technical dialogue. As we move now to a world in which there are problems about proliferation, should we do anything about moving to a non-nuclear world, all those questions, the interests of ourselves and the United States are really very similar, and there's every reason why we should stay close, talk closely, and so far as I know, we do. And I hope and believe that our people, though they have to, my successor, but whatever, has to think about lots of things that I don't have to think about. I hope that that they will maintain the sort of expertise in thinking about these things that we built up in those days.
Thank you.